Soviet territory were concerned, was involved in the purge in much the same way as the Soviet Party proper, Warsky was, after all, practically an old Bolshevik in almost the same sense as Rikhofor Kamenev. The Poles in Russia were to some degree comparable with the Irish in England, there were many of them, and they often played important roles in the life of the larger country. The purge affected not only the Polish party members, but the Polish population as a whole. The total Polish population is shown as 792,000 in the USSR census of 1926. The 1939 census, not indeed reliable, shows 626,000. Figures of their actual losses in the purge are hard to come by. According to a Polish communist, about 10,000 Poles from Moscow alone were shot at the time of the Bukharin trial, with a total of 50,000 in the country as a whole. Arrests of Polish communists had taken place sporadically all through the 1930s. Now the party as a whole was caught up in an unprecedented campaign of almost literal annihilation, both organizationally and physically. The survivors in the whole of the Polish communist movement and its following are said to have been about 70 or 80 in number. A Polish leader remarks, "Almost all the leaders and active members of the KPP then in the Soviet Union were arrested and sent to camps." It is certainly true that when a Polish communist government had to be formed in 1944, the leaders were scraped up from all over the place. The few who had the luck to remain in Polish jails, like Gomułka, had superimposed on them men like President Bierut, formerly, under the name Rutkowski, an NKVD interrogator, and his economic chief, Mink, who had been a lecturer in an institute in Central Asia. On 20 and August 21, 1937, Warsky, Bajinski, and others were shot. Warsky is said to have gone mad under interrogation and to have imagined that he was in the hands of the Gestapo. A number of Polish communist leaders then in Poland were invited to Moscow for consultation. They included Ring and Henry Kowski, both members of the Polish Politburo. The latter saw what was going on, and for weeks never ventured out of his room at the Lux except on nocturnal shopping for supplies. All eventually disappeared. From 1937 to 1939, all 12 members of the Central Committee present in Russia, and several hundred others, were executed. Among those who perished were all the party's representatives on the Executive Committee and the Control Commission of the Comintern, including the veteran Walecki. Before his arrest, Walecki provided an example of the way old revolutionaries had become humiliated and degraded. Walecki, who had always given friendly greetings to Newman's wife, met her in the Lux soon after Newman's arrest. "I smiled and nodded," she remembers, "but he looked away deliberately and there was an embarrassed, rather guilty expression on his face." Walecki was to confess that he was a spy. Tilde by September 11, 1937, the whole Polish Politburo had been arrested. Stalin signed a proposal on cleaning up the Polish party on November 28, 1937. Usually Stalin, after purging a party, could make use of the struggles over power and policy invariably prevalent to select a new leadership. But in this case, both factions in the Polish Communist Party in 1937 were accused of following the instructions of the Polish counter-revolutionary intelligence. It seems to have issued its last official statement on 8 June 1938 and to have been finally dissolved by a vote of the Presidium of the Exarchate on August 16, 1938. Agents of Polish fascism had managed to gain positions of leadership in it, according to the report of the Comintern delegate to the Soviet 18th Party Congress, Manuelski. Manuelski, making this report, referred also to police agents in the Hungarian and Yugoslav parties. When the accusations were announced to the Polish members of the International Brigade in Spain, they were received with silence and tears. The final batch of leaders, like Kostreva, were shot in 1939, when accounts were being settled with the whole Comintern apparatus. The left-wing poets Standen Wanderski and other literary men perished. The most important was Bruno Jasienski, of whom we have written in Chapter 10. The total dissolution of the Polish Communist Party was an extraordinary measure. It reflected simply the physical destruction of its cadres. It probably suffered little more than the Ukrainian party. But Stalin could not, of course, simply dissolve the Ukrainian party, since he needed someone to rule in Kiev. He did not, at the moment, have any immediate need of a group for ruling Poland and doubtless reflected that, as it turned out in practice, he could scrape one up from somewhere when and if required. The Polish party, moreover, was one in which hostility to the forthcoming Nazi-Soviet pact, with its partition of Poland, was likely to be strong. The wives of the arrested foreigners suffered like those of the Russian victims. But they had no relations to turn to. They remained entirely at the mercy of official caprice. First, they were involved in a continual struggle with the manager of the Lux, who soon contrived to transfer them from their rooms to a separate, older building on the other side of the courtyard, crowded in with other wives. From here, too, they were eventually evicted. Their papers were not in order, and they had to queue up regularly every 5 days to renew them. It was impossible to get jobs. They could live only by selling their possessions and books. It was common to try to keep the children from knowing what had happened to their fathers. Margareta Newman quotes a conversation. "Is your daddy arrested too?" "No, my daddy's on holiday in the Caucasus." And then the 11-year-old daughter of one of the arrested comrades destroyed the child's illusion. "Oh, he's in the Caucasus, is he? Why does your mother pay money into the prison, then? A fine Caucasus that is." But sooner or later, the wives were themselves arrested. On a single night in September 1937, all the Polish wives were taken. One that can be traced got 8 years forced labor, and this seems to have been the usual sentence. The Soviet representatives in the Comintern machinery were also destroyed, being blamed for collusion in the penetration of the enemy into the constituent parties. The exception was Manuelsky himself, who acted as Stalin's agent throughout. Described as a third-rate mind, he was willing to be the Comintern equivalent of a Meklis or a Skiryatov and thus survived. In his report on Comintern matters to the 18th Congress, after dealing with the Polish case, he significantly added, "It was the failure of Comintern workers that they allowed themselves to be deceived, and were late in taking measures against the contamination of the Communist parties by enemy elements." This referred primarily to two other members of the Central Committee of the CPSU, Pyatnitsky and Narin. Pyatnitsky was, apart from Manuelsky, the chief Soviet operator in the Comintern. He had served on its executive committee since 1923, and ran the key organization department. V.G. Narin, another Soviet representative on the Comintern executive committee, controlled the German and other parties. A Latvian, he is described as an honest man, but a dogmatist. He seems to have been denounced for permitting nationalist deviations as early as 1936. He was arrested in June 1937 as a Gestapo agent and is said to have been tortured particularly badly. Their subordinates fell with them, including their immediate aides, Grolman and Idelson. One of the lists Stalin signed for execution consisted of 300 Comintern operatives. Between 23 May and June 1, 1937, a wave of arrests swept the organization. The head of the Foreign Communications Department, Mirov Abramov, was taken with all his staff. It is said that he was accused of espionage for no fewer than 15 countries. He was named as a link between Yagoda and Trotsky in the Bukharin trial. Alekhinov, head of the Kadri department, was also arrested in the summer of 1937, as were the heads of the propaganda department, the organization department, and the press section. We can trace none of them further, presumably because they were shot en masse, under the list system. In general, a clean sweep was made of the organization, apart from such pliant figures as Kasinin. Dimitrov alone tried to save some of the victims. Killers abroad. It was comparatively easy to deal with the foreigners in Moscow. The operation of the purge in foreign countries called for more secret techniques. In December 1936, Yazhov organized in the NKVD an administration of special tasks. Under it were the so-called mobile groups, charged with special assassinations outside Russia. There was one problem in particular which he faced. He could not so easily dispose of the old NKVD cadres operating abroad under the Foreign Department as he could those in the internal departments. They could refuse to come and be arrested. He coped with this by two methods. First of all, when he arrested the other heads of departments in the Lubyanka, he left Slutsky to carry on in the best of orders. The Foreign Department, it became known, was not to be submitted to the purge needed for its more corrupt confreres. Numbers of operatives, impressed by this idea, returned to Russia, where they were mostly transferred and executed. The fate of some of them became known. For example, in the summer of 1937, the NKVD resident in France, Nikolai Smirnov, was recalled to Moscow and executed. At first, Yazhov pretended that he had simply been transferred to an underground job in China. But the true story leaked out to the NKVD station in France because the wife of another officer had chanced to see the arrest of Smirnov, when she was about to call on him at the Hotel Moskva. Yazhov then put out the story that Smirnov had been a spy for France and Poland. The NKVD officers in France deduced that this was untrue from the simple fact that their cipher for communication with Moscow was not changed. If Smirnov had indeed been a French spy, it must then be assumed that he had betrayed the cipher. Similarly, the old network of informers he had built up continued to operate, contrary to the laws of espionage. This sort of thing encouraged defection. Yazhov therefore strengthened his appeal for loyalty by another method. The mobile groups had as one of their first priorities the making of an example of any colleague who broke with Stalin. Ignaz Reiss, an NKVD resident in Switzerland, broke with the regime in July 1937. His body, riddled with bullets, was found on a road near Lausanne. The Swiss police also found in the abandoned baggage of the friend of Reiss's who had betrayed him a box of poisoned chocolates, apparently intended for his children. Aga Bakov, former Ogpu resident in Turkey, had broken with the regime as early as 1929. He was murdered in Belgium in 1938. Walter Kravitsky, whose book is a useful source for this period, had been NKVD resident in Holland. On February 10, 1941, he was found shot in a hotel room in Washington. When the situation among the spies abroad had been largely cleared up, it became possible finally to dispense with Slutsky. But in order to avoid troubling the agents still in the field, this was done tactfully. His death on February 17, 1938 was announced in a short friendly obituary the next day. In fact, he appears to have been poisoned by Frenovsky, by then deputy head of the NKVD, in his office, though a recent Soviet account makes it suicide. Slutsky's deputy, Spiegelglas, was suddenly called in and told that Slutsky had had a heart attack. Slutsky lay in state in the main hall of the NKVD club, with a guard of honor. But many NKVD officers had some smattering of forensic medicine and at once noticed on his cheeks the spots indicating cyanide poisoning. In Spain, Slutsky had recently given important service in Spain, which by now had become a major theater of operation for the purge, not only at the level of Gjalf's mobile groups, which roamed the country arresting and killing deviationists on the international scale, like Camillo Bernini. For there were also larger political issues, the suppression of Spanish Trotskyism and the gaining of effective control of the Spanish government. As early as December 1936, the Soviet press was speaking of the necessity for the elimination of PUM, the heretical Marxist Party of Catalonia, equivalent of the British ILP, that is to say, revolutionary socialists opposed to communist methods. It was not in any real sense Trotskyite, and the few genuine Spanish Trotskyites did not belong to it. While its 29th Division, in which George Orwell served, was fighting against Franco on the Aragon front, the Russians were able to secure its suppression. Yeste Hernandez, one of the two communists in the Spanish Republican government, tells us how he was summoned by the Soviet ambassador, Rosenberg, and introduced to Slutsky, then going under the pseudonym Marcos. Slutsky said that the suppression of PUM was an urgent matter. Not only was it openly criticizing the Soviet Union, and in particular the Zinoviev and Pyatakov trials, but it was attempting to bring Trotsky to Spain. There seems to be nothing in this latter allegation, but if the Russians believed it, Stalin might well have had qualms. In a civil war or a revolution, it could have been argued, Trotsky's name was worth 40,000 bayonets. In fact, such an idea was chimerical, and even to Spaniards not basically hostile to Trotsky the disadvantages of his presence must have outweighed the advantages. Rosenberg remarked that he had often told Spanish Prime Minister Largo Caballero that the liquidation of PUM interested Stalin personally, but that Largo Caballero would not listen to this. Slutsky made it clear that an alternative method was to be found, a provocation mounted by the NKVD which would allow the seizure of power in Barcelona by the communists, and give them the excuse to get rid of Largo Caballero if he attempted to undo the fait accompli. The operation was prepared by Antonov Avsenko, then Soviet consul general in Barcelona, and Erno Garo, later to be overthrown in the leadership of the Hungarian Communist Party by the Revolution of 1956, and at that time senior Comintern operative in Spain. On May 3, 1937, the subservient Spanish communist whom they had intruded into the leadership of the Catalan police, Rodriguez Sala, seized the Barcelona telephone exchange from the anarcho-syndicalist CNT trade unionists who had controlled it since the beginning of the war. The left-wing organizations, including PUM, resisted, and after 4 days of fighting, which is said to have caused about 1,000 deaths, they were put down by specially prepared police troops brought in from Valencia and elsewhere. On 15 May, the communist ministers in the Spanish cabinet asked for the formal suppression of PUM. But even so, Largo Caballero again refused. Stalin's orders to get rid of Largo Caballero and to put in Dr. Negrin as premier were now transmitted to the Spanish Politburo at a meeting with the Comintern representatives, including Togliatti and Garo. Immediately after the formation of the Negrin government, the new director general of security, the communist Colonel Ortega, told Hernandez that Orlov, the NKVD chief for Spain, had had him sign a number of warrants for the arrest of PUM leaders, without his superior, the Minister of the Interior, being informed. Orlov himself told Hernandez that the leaders of PUM would be exposed as being in collusion with a group of Franco spies already under arrest. Hernandez recounts that the majority of the Spanish communist leadership, though acting loyally in accordance with the Comintern directives, was disgusted with the whole affair. The Secretary General, José Díaz, who was later to jump or be pushed from his window into Belize, spoke of this spiritual death which had come over him. Filiati and Dolores Ibarri, La Pasionaria, a communist who was never to be afflicted with qualms of conscience, had sent the assault guards commander in Catalonia in order to arrest the PUM leadership. On 16 June, Andrés Nin, political secretary of PUM and former secretary of the Red Trade Union International in Moscow, who had held the portfolio of justice in the Catalan autonomous government, was arrested. He was taken to Alcalá, to a prison in communist hands. There he was seized by a group of men, including Orlov and Vittorio Vidali, an old Comintern agent later to be involved in the murder of Trotsky, and after the war to lead the anti-Titoite communists in Trieste. He was removed to El Pardo and there submitted to a Soviet-style investigation. First he was interrogated for 30 hours in relays, without success, and then tortured. At the end of a few days, his face was no more than a formless mass. However, no confession could be obtained from him, and he seems either to have been killed or to have died under interrogation. El Campesino was told that he was buried on the spot. The formation in France of the Committee for the Defense of PUM and, even more, a strong but simple letter demanding merely a fair deal and treatment of the PUM accused, signed by Agide, Mauriac, Demel, Roger Martin Dugard, and others, seems to have had an effect in Spain and even on Negrín. In the case of the senior PUM leaders still surviving, the government was able to insist on no further disappearances, though the rank and file were shot freely. Julian Gorkin, representative of PUM on the Central Committee of the People's Militia, was one of those who survived. Hernandez takes the view that an important motive of Stalin's was to show that not only in Russia, but also in a democratic country governed by the Popular Front, Trotskyites had been proved traitors. Thus it was a question not simply of pursuing the feud and destroying all Trotskyite bases, but also of obtaining an ostensible non-Soviet confirmation of the existence of Trotskyite plots. Meanwhile, the vulnerable units of the International Brigade were being combed for Trotskyites. For example, Walter Ulbricht was conducting among the German brigaders the Spanish end of the purge which was sweeping the German communists in Moscow. The seconded Red Army commander Kleber, commanding the International Brigade, was removed in February 1937 and soon afterward arrested. The Soviet soldiers in Spain, who must have resented the NKVD actions, were often shot on return, as we have seen. Ironically, as Stalin carried out his will as regards purges and control over the political machinery in Spain, he lost interest in the outcome of the actual war. Ehrenberg tells us that though the Soviet authorities expressed great indignation at fascist and Nazi intervention in Spain, as soon as it became evident that the Republicans were fighting a losing battle, this interest became a mere formality. Ehrenberg's own dispatches, sometimes sent with considerable risk, were cut, altered, or simply thrown into the waste paper basket. Many Spaniards who managed to escape the final debacle made their way to Moscow 150 in a single boat plus about 6,000, including 2,000 children, is the figure given. They found themselves facing a different danger. This wave of political refugees of the left had been preceded by others. After the defeat of the Socialist Rising in Vienna in 1934, several hundred members of the Socialist Defense Organization Schutzbund took refuge in Russia. They were welcomed as heroes, and marched past in a body in the Red Square to applause and congratulations. By mid-1937, they had been arrested and sent to camps almost without exception. Some of their dependents, with children to feed and no source of income, having been fired from their jobs, went in 1938 to the German embassy, now controlled by the Nazis, in an attempt to get back to their homes. The Nazis put them up in the embassy building and escorted them to the Soviet registration office for foreigners to get permission to go back. Apparently, some succeeded. The Austrians were, in the main, non-communists. While, like them, the Spanish Republican rank and file was gradually deported to Central Asia and elsewhere, the leadership of the Spanish Communist Party became involved in the more political purge that had long been sweeping the Comintern apparatus and the foreign parties based in Moscow. Soon General González, El Campesino, after a long wrangle with a Comintern commission, was digging in the Moscow metro, preparatory to being sent to a northern labor camp, and the General Secretary of the Spanish Communist Party, Díaz, had died in dubious circumstances. They were known casualties. In all, by 1948, only 1,500 of the 6,000 are reported to have survived. The Trotsky murder. Abroad, one major piece of unfinished business remained. Rakovsky had remarked in his last plea that even beyond the Mexican meridian, Trotsky will not escape that complete, final, shameful ignominy which we all are undergoing here. But this prediction had not yet been fulfilled in a literal sense. Since his expulsion from the Soviet Union in 1929, Trotsky, from Turkey, Norway, and finally Mexico, had loomed hugely in the Stalinist mythology as a diabolical figure, sunk in the morass of Nazi intelligence and finally responsible for the whole vast plot whose subordinate branches were continually being uprooted in Russia by a vigilant NKVD. In reality, he was trying to organize a political movement on a world scale. Odd sects of the communist movement joined his Fourth International. But in the USSR itself, his influence was practically nil. He was a figure offstage in all the events we have recounted. His main participation in Soviet affairs was simply as a commentator and analyst from outside. In his Bulletin of the Opposition, he presented his ideas of the current situation in the country, and made recommendations for correct action by anti-Stalinist communists. For all his vigor and polemical skill, his ideas are notable mainly for two things. First, a total lack of solicitude for the non-communist victims of the regime, no sympathy whatever was expended, for example, on the debt of the collectivization famine. Second, an unbelievable ineptitude in political judgment. It is natural that there should hang about Trotsky the glamour of a lost cause. This is a normal historical sentimentalism, reminding one of Scottish feelings about Bonnie Prince Charlie, entertained by many who would admit when it came to it that there is a vast difference between their hero fleeing persecuted through the Western Isles and the certainly unpleasant results of an actual Jacobite restoration. To attribute too much political virtue, or political intelligence, to Trotsky, as Malcolm Muggeridge has done, on account of his vivacious pen or even of the combination of an independent mind, courage, high spirits and unshakable resolution, seems a similarly romantic view. Muggeridge gives the impression of a rebel against all tyranny. But this needs to be very severely qualified. During the period when Trotsky held power, he was, whatever his personal magnetism, a ruthless imposer of the party's will who firmly crushed the democratic opposition within the party and fully supported the rules which in 1921 gave the ruling group total authority. And the crushing of the Kronstadt rebellion was as much his personal battle honor as the seizure of power had been. He was the leading figure among the doctrinaire leftist Bolsheviks who were finding it hard to stomach Lenin's concessions to the peasantry, and preferred a far more rigorous regime, even before Stalin came round to the same view. Trotsky might have carried out such policies less crudely than Stalin. But he would have used, as ever, as much violence as he thought necessary, and that would not have been a small amount. But more destructive still to the image of the good old rebel was his attitude to the Stalin regime. Even when in exile during the 1930s, Trotsky was not by any means a forthright revolutionary out to destroy a tyranny. His attitude was rather that of a loyal opposition. In 1931, he published his key manifesto, The Problems of the Development of the USSR. This accepted the main lines of Stalin's program, defined Stalinist Russia as a proletarian state, and simply quarreled with Stalin about which phase of evolution toward socialism had been attained. Trotsky stood, in fact, not for the destruction of the Stalinist system but for its takeover and patching up by an alternative group of leaders. In the autumn of 1932, Trotsky wrote in a letter to his son, "At present Milyukov, the Mensheviks and Thermidorians of all sorts, will willingly echo the cry 'Remove Stalin.' Yet, it may still happen within a few months that Stalin may have to defend himself against Thermidorian pressure, and that we may have temporarily to support him. This being so, the slogan 'Down with Stalin' is ambiguous and should not be raised as a war cry at this moment." In his bulletin, Trotsky wrote, "If the bureaucratic equilibrium in the USSR were to be upset at present, this would almost certainly benefit the forces of counter-revolution." Trotsky was always arguing that a Thermidor was being prepared, with the support of petty bourgeois elements. Obsessed with comparisons with the French Revolution, he continually spoke of Thermidor and Brumaire. The parallels between Stalin and either the Directory or Napoleon are interesting, but the differences are so great that for purposes of practical politics they are not worth taking into account. Stalin's regime, indeed, Lenin's regime, had its own laws of development and potentialities. And when Stalin established his autocracy, it was comparable with other despotisms of the past, but hardly with those of 18th and 19th century France. Trotsky was attentive to the lessons of history, but they were not the lessons of Russian history. If instead of worrying about Barras and Bonaparte he had given some thought to Ivan the Terrible, it might have been more to the point. Trotsky had objected to Lenin's machine right up to 1917, but having then accepted it, had never again denounced it in principle or seen that Stalinism, or something like it, was its natural product. The furthest he went was to say that it was rather tempting to suggest that the Stalin system was already rooted in Bolshevik centralism, or, more sweepingly, in the underground hierarchy of professional revolutionaries. Trademark. Since Stalinist historiography is so extravagantly unreliable, there has been a tendency for historians to accept Trotsky's account of certain events. In the intrigues following Lenin's death, he was by no means straightforward, but at once devious and faint-hearted, and his own account is pathetic in its half-truths and attempts to gloss over the facts. This is natural enough, and the only problem is why Trotsky's virtually unsupported word should have been so widely accepted. Partly, no doubt, because his books, written under the comparatively critical eye of the West, were not so wildly and unashamedly falsified as their Stalinist competitors, partly because the Trotskyite tradition has trickled here and there into the mainstream of independent historical writing. But Trotsky had never failed in his duty to suppress or misrepresent facts in the interests of politics. And his general reliability on the period in question could have been considered in the light of his accusation that Stalin poisoned Lenin. There is no evidence whatever that this is true, and Trotsky himself only brought it up many years later, in 1939. The only serious point in favor of it is not evidential at all, but simply a consideration of cui bono insofar as Lenin's death saved Stalin from the loss of his main positions of power. But it is more reasonable to see in Trotsky's accusation a lesser, mirror image of Stalin's own habit of mind in making wild accusations of treachery against political opponents. When people say that Trotsky had an attractive personality, they are speaking mainly of his public persona, his appearance before great meetings, his writings, his dignity. But even so, he repelled many who felt him to be full of vanity, on the one hand, and irresponsible, on the other, in the sense that he tended to make a bright or brilliant formulation and press it to the end regardless of danger. Stalin's colorless, short-view remarks carried more conviction. Their very drabness gave them a realism. In a period of comparatively down-to-earth problems, the great revolutionary, like the great theoretician Bukharin, did not feel at home. Whatever his aberrations, Trotsky had a good deal in him of the European Marxist tradition. As Russia lapsed into isolation, the Asian element he had before the revolution denounced in the Bolsheviks came to the fore. A Soviet diplomat told Siliga that the country was, after all, Asiatic, the way of Genghis Khan and Stalin suits it better than the European civilization of Lev Davidovich. Trotsky's vanity, unlike Stalin's, was, practically speaking, frivolous. There was something more histrionic about it. He had shown himself no less ruthless than Stalin. Indeed, at the time of the Civil War, he had ordered executions on a greater scale than Stalin or anyone else. Even in this, he showed some of the attributes of a poseur, the great revolutionary dramatically and inexorably carrying out the cruel will of history. If Trotsky had come to power, this concern for his image would no doubt have made him rule in a less ruthless, or, rather, a less crudely ruthless, fashion than Stalin. The Soviet peoples would perhaps have been able to say, "What his hard heart denies, his charitable vanity supplies." Stalin's pragmatic approach gave the impression of a sounder man, and in a sense this was a true impression. He was always capable of retreat, from the calling off of the disastrous collectivization wave in March 1930 to the ending of the Berlin blockade in 1949. Stalin's skills and Soviet political methods make Trotsky look superficial, and the conclusion seems inevitable that he had far more to him than his rival. A mind may be intelligent, abilities may be brilliant, yet there are other qualities less apparent to the observer, without which such gifts have a certain slightness to them. Trotsky was a polished zircon, Stalin was a rough diamond. Trotsky and his son Lev Sedov had been deprived of Soviet citizenship on February 20, 1932. They had not, as is sometimes said, been condemned to death by the courts, at least not openly. It had been announced as part of the verdicts in the Zinoviev and Pyatakov cases that they would be liable to immediate arrest and trial in the event of their being discovered on the territory of the USSR. Trotsky boldly challenged the Soviet government to seek his extradition from Norway, which would have meant the examination of his evidence in the Norwegian courts. Instead, it put pressure on the Norwegian government to expel Trotsky. Through the painter Diego Rivera, he obtained asylum from President Cardenas of Mexico, and on January 9, 1937 reached that country in a Norwegian tanker. Like Lenin, who welcomed and protected Malinovsky and other Tsarist spies within the Bolshevik party, even when they came under suspicion from the rest of his entourage, Trotsky proved gullible about his contacts. Lenin's defense had been the rather inadequate one that even while Malinovsky was betraying Bolsheviks, he was also having to work hard and well to make new ones. Trotsky took the view that if he refused to meet any but his oldest and closest disciples, he would lose important opportunities to preach his doctrines and gain new followers. The plot against Trotsky was tied in with a murky world of Soviet espionage in the United States, and some of it was only unraveled after the arrest of Jack Sobel in 1957. Sobel had spied on Trotsky as early as 1931 and 1932, with useful results. The next NKVD agent to penetrate Trotsky's political family was the extraordinary Mark Zborovsky, of whom it has been said that he everywhere left behind a trail of duplicity and blood worthy of a Shakespearean villain, and who, after establishing himself in the United States as a respectable anthropologist at Columbia and Harvard, was finally exposed and convicted on charges of perjury in December 1958, getting a 5-to-7-year term. Zborovsky had managed to become Sadov's right-hand man, and had access to all the secrets of the Trotskyites. He was responsible for the robbery of the Trotsky archives in Paris in November 1936. Although he never committed any murders himself, remaining a finger man, he seems to have played some role in the killing of Ignaz Rice. He also nearly procured the death of Walter Kravitsky in 1937, and did succeed in having Trotsky's secretary, Erwin Wolff, murdered in Spain. The young German Rudolf Clement, secretary of Trotsky's Fourth International, seems also to have been conveyed into his murderer's hand by Zborovsky, in 1938. A headless body found floating in the Seine in Paris was tentatively identified as Clement's. In any case, he has not been seen since. On February 14, 1938, Trotsky's son Lev Sadov died in suspicious circumstances in a Paris hospital 1L. Since Zborovsky was the man who rushed him there, there is a very strong presumption that he informed the NKVD killer organization of the opportunity which now presented itself. That Trotsky himself survived as late as 1940 is probably due to the breakdown of the NKVD foreign department as a result of Yuzhov's and Beria's purge of it and the difficulties produced by the defection of high officers like Lushkov and Orlov. Moreover, after some sort of attempt on Trotsky's life which seems to have been made in January 1938, very strict security measures were taken at the villa where he now settled at Coyoacan, outside Mexico City. Apart from Trotsky's own guards, considerable police protection was provided. The planning of the attempts on Trotsky was now entrusted to a large staff, who made minute preparations. The Trotsky dossier in the NKVD registry at 2 Dzerzhinsky Street occupied three floors. We can certainly deduce a main motive of Stalin's as the simple physical destruction of all alternative leaderships. No further blackening of Trotsky's character was necessary or possible. In every sense except that of killing his great enemy, Stalin could only expect a political debit from the operation. It was the same concern as was to be shown in the execution of long lists of military and other men already serving in camps, at precisely the two defensive crises of the Second World War. The organization of Trotsky's murder was assigned to Leonid Eitingon, a high NKVD officer, who was given virtually unlimited funds for the purpose. Eitingon had been sent to Spain to work under Orlov, taking the pseudonym Kotov, in 1936. He had already had considerable experience of terrorist activity abroad. He continued with this career for many years. The agent Nikolai Kokloy, sent to Germany to assassinate anti-Soviet émigré leaders, who defected to the West in April 1954, had worked under him. Eitingon seems to have been sentenced to 12 years imprisonment after the fall of Beria in 1953, but to have been released in the late 1960s, getting a job in publishing. Eitingon set off for Mexico, taking with him Vittorio Codevilla, a founder of the Argentine Communist Party and a trusted Stalinist, who had been involved in the murder of Andrés Nin, and Vittorio Vidali, another of the most formidable of the killers from Spain. The Mexican Communist Party, under its leader Herman Laborde, had been a genuine political trend, and was lukewarm about such action against Trotsky. As part of the move against Trotsky, Laborde and his followers were purged in an intransigent group, including the painter Siqueiros, placed at the head of the party. Taking the name of Lonef, Eitingon organized his first attempt on Trotsky on a lavish scale. The central figure was Siqueiros. On May 23, 1940, Siqueiros and two accomplices collected a number of submachine guns, police and army uniforms, and some ladders and incendiary bombs, together with a rotary power saw. He dressed himself as a major in the Mexican army and put on a disguise. At about 2 a.m., he assembled the 20 men he had chosen, and they drove in four cars to Trotsky's fortified villa. Some of the police had already been lured away. The others were trussed up at gunpoint. The telephone lines were cut, and the sentry on duty, an American called Hart, was rushed and overwhelmed. The force broke into the patio and swept the bedrooms with Tommy guns for several minutes. They then pulled out, leaving several incendiaries and a large dynamite bomb. The latter failed to explode. Trotsky was slightly wounded in the right leg, his 10-year-old grandson was also hit. His wife received some burns from the incendiaries, Otherwise, the attack was a failure. The body of Hart was found, shot, buried in the grounds of a villa rented by Siqueiros. The Mexican Communist Party disowned the attack and dissociated itself from Siqueiros and Vidali. By 17 June, the identity of the attackers had been established by the Mexican police. Siqueiros was arrested in a hideout in the provinces in September 1940, but although the facts were established, great political pressures were now brought to bear. At the same time, intellectuals and artists urged the president to take into account the fact that artists and men of science are considered as the bulwark of culture and progress. As a result, the court accepted Siqueiros's plea that the firing of 300 bullets into the bedrooms had been for psychological purposes only, without any intention of killing or hurting anyone. Evidence that when Siqueiros heard of Trotsky's survival he had exclaimed, "All that work in vain," was disregarded. The facts about Hart's death were found not to constitute a prima facie case of murder. The judge claimed that the accused did not form a criminal conspiracy, since a conspiracy could not be made for a single temporary job but must have stability and permanence. They were even acquitted of impersonating police officers, on the grounds that though they had dressed up in uniforms, they had not actually attempted to usurp any police functions. While Siqueiros was still out on bail, a convenient invitation to paint some murals in Chile, at the instance of the Chilean communist poet Pablo Neruda, led to his decamping thither. So even the light sentence he might have got for the crime still attributed to him, stealing the two automobiles outside the Trotsky house, was avoided. On the failure of Siqueiros, Eitingon had put a second plan into operation. 4 days after the first attempt, Ramon Mercader was introduced to Trotsky for the first time. Mercader's mother, Caridad, a Spanish communist, seems to have become sexually entangled with Eitingon during the civil war in Spain, when she had worked in the liquidation squads. The NKVD made a practice of securing the passports of members of the International Brigade who had been killed. Mercader was given one which had originally belonged to a Yugoslav-Canadian volunteer killed in action early in the war. It had been reforged under the name of Jackson, a curious example of the absurd slips which crop up in these otherwise highly skilled operations, though in fact this attracted no attention. The plot now reached into the world of outwardly respectable New York leftism, which at the time was seething with intra-communist intrigue, and provided a ready recruiting ground for Yazhov's men. In fact, general supervision of the murder seems to have come under the purview of the permanent resident of the NKVD, the Soviet Consul General in New York, Gayakov Akimian, who was later exposed, in May 1941, and expelled from the country. The details, some of which are even now a little obscure, do not concern us here. But it is at least interesting to note, in this, as in the great espionage cases of the 1940s and 1950s, how many people, of whom their non-party acquaintances would have certainly denied any possibility of their joining in such activity, were, from factiousness, revolutionary romanticism, and even idealism, to become willing or half-willing accomplices in a vulgar murder. These put Mercader in touch with Sylvia Agilov, an American Trotskyite who was a social worker. He seduced her and entered into a relationship with her which passed for marriage. She was entirely innocent of the planned crime. Through her, he was admitted to the Trotsky household. Over the next few months, Mercader made 5 or 6 visits and, as Sylvia Agilov's husband, became reasonably established. On 20 August, he arrived at Trotsky's villa, ostensibly to have an article he had written criticized. He wore a raincoat. A long dagger was sewn into the lining. A revolver was in his pocket. But his actual weapon, a cut-down ice axe, was in his raincoat pocket. An NKVD murder, of a Soviet ambassador, by a strong assassin using an iron bar is reported by the Petrovs. Mercader was an experienced mountain climber, and his choice of the ice axe as an assassination weapon was based on considerable experience of its use and power. Outside, his car was parked facing the right way for a quick move. And around the corner another car with his mother and an agent was waiting. Eitingon, in yet a third car, was a block or so away. Trotsky had 2 revolvers on his desk, and the switch to an alarm system within reach. But as soon as he started to read Mercader's article, the assassin took out his ice axe and struck him a tremendous blow on the head. Mercader had planned to leave quickly. But the blow was not immediately lethal. Trotsky screamed for very long, infinitely long, as Mercader himself put it, a cry prolonged and agonized, half scream, half sob, according to one of the guards, who now rushed in and seized the assassin. Trotsky was operated on, and survived for more than a day after that, dying on August 21, 1940. He was nearly 62. Mercader, coming to trial after Siqueiros, seems to have hoped that he, too, might get a light sentence. Perhaps the judge would hold that he had been teaching Trotsky how to climb the Alps. But he was sentenced to 20 years imprisonment, which he served. Even after his identity had been established by fingerprints, he refused to admit who he was or why he had committed the murder. The official Stalinist version was that he was a disgruntled Trotskyite, and that the NKVD had nothing to do with it. Marek Adair's imprisonment was passed under conditions superior to those prevailing in Soviet prisons and camps. The Mexican Revolution had effected genuine reform. A visitor notes, his cell, spacious and sunny, with a little open-air patio in front, contained a neat bed and a table loaded with books and magazines. He was also, under Mexican law, allowed women in his cell. On his release, he went to Czechoslovakia, moving from that country, when it became too liberal, to Moscow in 1968, though he is later reported in Havana. Idingon and Sailor America Dare left by the prepared escape route. She was received in Moscow by Beria, presented to Stalin, and decorated, for her son and herself. And, indeed, the destruction of Stalin's last great opponent must have caused great satisfaction in the Kremlin. For once, it might have been noted, a prediction of Trotsky's had been literally fulfilled. He had written of Stalin, in 1936, he seeks to strike, not at the ideas of his opponent, but at his skull. 14. Climax. Each day two slew its thousand six or seven. Byron. After the Bukharin trial, Stalin and Yazhov turned their attention to the remnant of opposition at the top. This final wave of the purge in the inner party, directed against his own supporters, was well defined by a circular put out under Stalin's instructions, in April 1938, calling for a liquidation of the consequences of wrecking in which the silent politically spineless people should also not be forgotten. Various loose ends were tied up, for example, the first secretary in Kazakhstan, L. Imerzian, whom Stalin had attacked at the January plenum, was arrested on Stalin's personal orders. There remained bigger game. Postishev's arrest was not immediately followed up. Ek, Kosyurp, and Chubar, the doomed members of the Politburo, still featured, though not regularly, with the other members in formal listings, telegrams from the Soviet expedition at the North Pole, and so forth. Ek and Kosyurp, appearing in good standing until the last week in April, went first. Ek was arrested on 29th of April, and Kosyurp, mentioned in an electoral list as late as 28th of April, at about the same time in accordance with the NKVD custom of arresting people just before holidays, during which no attempt could be made to trace them. Stalin was now wholly ignoring the formalities. We are told that there was no exchange of opinions or political bureau decisions about the arrest of Kosyurp, or in any other case of this type. No announcement was made, then or ever, though his arrest must have become known immediately to those interested, for Kiev radio just ceased to announce itself as Radio Kosyurp, as it had done for some years. The press had other matters to think of. For most of May and June, the new election campaign built up in newspapers, meetings, and any other feasible fashion, on the lines of the fanfares of the previous winter. When the elections finally took place on 26th of June, it was to the accompaniment of another exploit by Stalinist Falcons, a non-stop flight to Khabarovsk in the Far East by Kakinaki. The absence of both men from the 1st of May demonstrations was noted. Chubar was still there. He can be traced as receiving official greetings as late as 9th of June. By 1st of July, he was no longer listed. Chubar was later said to have been concerned with shortcomings in industry, and to have had qualms about the new agricultural system. He had been closely associated with Orjonikidze and was not pleased with the development of the cult of personality. In the period before his own removal, he is reported as deeply indignant about the facts he had learned about illegal repressions. He did not believe that people he had known and worked with for years were really spies. His views on this became known to those in charge of the purge. On his removal from membership in the Politburo and vice-chairmanship of the Council of People's Commissars, he was sent for the moment to work at Solikamsk in the Urals. But he remained there for only a few months, soon he was arrested. Meanwhile Ek, in the new torture center for top officials at Sukhanovka, was being interrogated by the notorious CM Ushakov. Soon his ribs were broken, and he was confessing to being leader of a reserve net supposedly created by Bukharin in 1935. This was presumably what was mentioned at the Bukharin trial as another reserve center, allegedly existing at the end of 1935 or the beginning of 1936, when Rykov was supposed to have urged Chernov to get in touch with it through Lyubimov. It was another reserve center because there was also reference to the parallel group of rights allegedly led by Antipov. There is at least some slight logic in this representation of the latest victims as rightists. They had no connection whatever with the Trotsky or Zinoviev oppositions, and though they had equally opposed the Bukharinites in 1929-1930, They had been in favor of a lessening of the terror and reconciliation with Bukharin. The plan for the next trial was, in any case, changed. Ek was instructed to remove his name as reserve center leader and substitute Ms. Laux. This left a number of ready victims for the first trial planned wholly against Stalinists, leaving the more recently arrested Politburo members and some others in reserve for future use. On 28 July, Yazhov sent Stalin a list of 138 names, asking for permission to execute them. Stalin and Molotov signed, "Shoot all 138. Thereupon, on 27-29 July, and after the weekend on 1 August, there took place in secret by far the largest massacre of the leadership in the whole period. We have already noted the 24 known military victims, see here. In addition, at least 22 leading political, diplomatic, and cultural names can be identified. They included Rudzutak, formerly full member and more recently candidate member of the Politburo, V. Imislauk, Pyatnitsky, Rukimovich, Narin, Stetsky, M. I. Frumkin, who had been the leading rightist spokesman in the late 1920s, A. Yakovlev, and Krylenko. V. M. Kershin, a playwright with strong political connections, was among the other victims. In every case we can trace, they were tried by the military collegium. How the military and political elements in the supposed plot were melded is not clear, but, for example, the civilian Rudzutak was directly linked to the army figure Berzin, as a Latvian spy, as was army commander Alksnys, who was savagely beaten by a special team. Rudzutak pleaded his innocence. He had made a confession, but now retracted it and asked that the party central committee be informed that there is in the NKVD an as yet not liquidated center which is craftily manufacturing cases, which forces innocent persons to confess. There is no opportunity to prove one's non-participation in crimes to which the confessions of various persons testify. The investigative methods are such that they force people to lie and to slander entirely innocent persons in addition to those who already stand accused. He asks the court that he be allowed to inform the party central committee of all this in writing. He assures the court that he personally never had any evil designs in regard to the policy of our party because he had always agreed with the party policy pertaining to all spheres of economic and cultural activity. However, sentence was pronounced on him in 20 minutes and he was shot. The charges included espionage for Germany. Krylenko's trial also lasted 20 minutes, and the protocol ran to 19 lines only. 20 minutes was also the time taken by the trial of M.E. Mikhailov, provincial secretary of Voronezh. Pyatnitsky, who had been severely beaten by the NKVD officer Longfong, undergoing 18 torture sessions and suffering broken ribs, internal injuries, and a lacerated face, was accused of espionage for Japan and other countries in addition to having been a Tsarist police agent. We can trace a few relatives of the accused. Rudzutak's wife was sent to labor camp, his brother is reported to have emigrated to America and taken the name Rogers, but to have returned in the early 1930s at the invitation of his then-powerful relation. He and his wife are reported shot, and their 19-year-old daughter, Senta, arrested and sentenced to death for espionage for the United States, but reprieved and sent to the Vorkuta camps. Yakovlev's wife is reported sentenced to death. Rukimovich's young daughter Elena was jailed in 1939, together with the daughters of Shliapnikov's ally, Medvedev, of Lomov, of Smilga, and of Krestinsky, for having formed an anti-Soviet group. Anschlik's sister, Stephanie Brun, got 8 years. Ms. Lauk's first wife also got an 8-year sentence and died of dysentery in a transit camp in the Far East. This case marks a turning point in the purge. There were to be no more public trials of party figures. But it is also interesting because it comes at the moment when Stalin was beginning to show distrust of Yazhov. Yazhov had been appointed People's Commissar for Water Transport, in addition to his NKVD commissariat, secretaryship of the Central Committee, and membership on the Executive Committee of the Comintern, on April 8, 1938. This is often thought of as the beginning of his decline. But in fact his new commissariat's main component was the Soviet Merchant Marine, an important secret police area from both the security and the intelligence points of view. He seldom went to the Water Transport Commissariat, leaving the NKVD veteran E.G. Yevdokimov in charge. Others from the NKVD now ran the Timber Industry and Communications Commissariats. And on the same day as Yazhov's new appointment, Kaganovich took over railways in addition to heavy industry, but one of Yazhov's deputy commissars in the NKVD, L. N. Belsky, became first deputy People's Commissar of Railways, with the head of the NKVD Transport Department, M. A. Volkov, as another deputy commissar, and other NKVD officers in posts there. In addition, Several NKVD men now took over as provincial party secretaries. All in all, Yazhov's power seemed strongly on the increase. However, this now began to change. One party organization had remained not indeed exempt from purging, but only carrying out such purging as benefited its own leader, that of Georgia under Beria. It seems very out of character for Yazhov not to have attempted the destruction of the leading cadres in Tbilisi, and there are indeed reports that he was maneuvering to do this in 1938. It is said that Beria was to be arrested, but successfully appealed, being supported by Molotov and others. Beria's appointment on about July 20, 1938 to be deputy head of the NKVD can only be interpreted as the beginning of Yazhov's decline. It was a post that had previously been held by men like Amberman and Agranov, that is, not one suitable for an important party figure. In fact, Beria was clearly being prepared as a possible successor. He moved into the dacha just vacated by Chubar. There is a report that Yazhov and Kaganovich have clashed, not on any question of the desirability of the Great Purge, but on a more direct issue of power. Kaganovich himself supervised the purging of his commissariats and other organs under his own control, but resented NKVD intrusion except for the technical purposes of arrest, shooting, and so on. According to one account, Yazhov began to implicate Kaganovich himself, and had already forced Bondarenko, head of the Kharkov Tractor Works, to make statements compromising him. On one view, the immediate reason why Stalin listened to the voices being raised against Yazhov is that he had failed to set up further public trials, in particular that of the Rightist Reserve Center, plus a second military trial. It is quite conceivable that Yazhov had been charged with setting up a fourth great trial, and had failed in the assignment. If this were so, the coincidence of Beria's appointment and the immediately following secret trial or trials would signify the winding up of an unsatisfactory project by the new management. But Stalin had for some time been shooting prominent Central Committee members without such formality, and it is difficult to see what further benefits he could now gain from another public trial. Every possible lesson had been rubbed in a Bukharin trial. As far as a second military trial was concerned, the first had not taken place in public, and the second could have been announced in precisely the same way. Indeed, the mere fact that the new batch of military conspirators was dispatched without public announcement seems to show that Stalin no longer felt the need for such. Whatever plans Stalin may have had for the future, it was, anyhow, at this point that he abandoned public trials of oppositionists. None of the figures still under arrest was brought before public courts, though almost all seem to have had confessions tortured out of them and to have been brought before these 20-minute sessions of the military collegium. It seems to have been difficult to extract reliable and durable confessions from the new Stalinist prisoners. Rudzutak, and Eek after him, would not repeat before the secret courts which eventually tried them the confessions they had made under torture. This had been true of a number of those who had fallen in the earlier phase of the purge, but there had been an adequate residuum of confessors. None of the new victims, though, had anything whatever to reproach themselves for from the point of view of having collaborated in any of the oppositions, and could hardly be asked to disarm. This had been true only of one or two second-rank prisoners in the Bukharin trial. Some of the difficulty may have resided in the fact that those in this middle generation were still rather more than personal nominees or members of Stalin's extremist entourage. They were still men following their political convictions, attached to Stalin as a leader, but not committed to the idea of his leadership as a matter of ideological dogma. Unlike the men Stalin had assembled from the earlier generation, and against many of whom he was able to exert something like blackmail, almost all the younger cadres were secure in the consciousness of their general and political innocence, if not from our point of view, at least from their own. Through the autumn, the NKVD commissar continued to appear with his old prominence. In fact, he was often named higher than his official standing in the Politburo, sometimes before Mikoyan, Andreev, and Zhdanov. And he continued his policies. The purge had grown in size, until finally it had reached such monstrous proportions that even Stalin seems to have seen that the time had come to ease off. This was a matter of major policy. The midsummer changes were perhaps no more than the first moves towards an alternative, based more on particular failures than on the realization that a dead end was being reached in the entire terror. Diplomats. Meanwhile, another rumored trial failed to take place. After the Bukharin trial, it had been rumored that a special trial of diplomats, centering on Antonov Avsinko, would be held. But in fact they were dealt with seriatim. Soviet diplomats had already suffered severely. For example, Taliarov, ambassador to Mongolia, had been shot in June 1937. Both Krestinsky and Sokolnikov had served as deputy people's commissars for foreign affairs. Karakhan had been ambassador in Berlin. Various lesser figures had been involved in the trials, for example, Klinov, of whom it was said in the Bukharin trial indictment that his case would be subject to special proceedings. Others implicated in the Bukharin trial were Yurinov, ambassador to Berlin, Bogomolov, ambassador to China, and Sabanin, director of the legal department of the People's Commissariat of Foreign Affairs. Yurinov and Begzadian, ambassador to Hungary, were among the victims of the July 1938 massacre. At the Foreign Commissariat, an NKVD officer, Vasily Korzenko, was appointed chief of personnel, and he and his family moved into Krestinsky's Moscow house. The treatment of the commissariat's staff for comparatively minor offenses was interestingly described in a Soviet article of the Khrushchev period. V.N. Barkov had long been head of the protocol department. On one occasion, on the instructions of Dekanozov, who was at the time a deputy people's of the most active members of the Beria gang, Barkov had to meet a foreign correspondent. Under the regulations in force, on the day of his talk with the correspondent, Barkov had to see Dekanozov without fail, but Dekanozov was nowhere to be found. Obeying the orders he had received, Barkov saw the correspondent. On the following day Dekanozov summoned him. "Who gave you direct permission for the interview? He could not find you anywhere. You could not have tried very hard." The dressing down went on for a long time. Barkov lost his temper and said, "But on that day you could not be found." "Oh, it's like that, is it?" said Dekanozov menacingly, and closed the interview. On that day Barkov never returned home. His relations only saw him 18 years later. The People's Commissar himself, Litvinov, beginning in 1937, and for the rest of his life, kept a revolver to hand, so that if the bell rang in the night, he would not have to live through the consequences. His deputy People's Kornmissar, V.S. Stamenikov, attempted suicide on arrest, to die in the prison hospital. One. Diplomats disappeared by the dozen. They had, indeed, had genuine contacts with foreigners, so that the presumption of their guilt was, by Azhov's standards, overwhelming. They were recalled and shot. In his memoirs, Ehrenberg says that few survived. He names nine that he knew personally whom Stalin liquidated. But no trial took place. In particular, Antonov Avsenko simply went through a routine processing. He had been a Menshevik until 1917. He had led two local rebellions in 1905 and 1906 and had been sentenced to death in 1906. He had been arrested several times for underground activity afterward. This record shows, incidentally, how mistaken is the notion that the Mensheviks were politically inactive because their views on party organization differed from Lenin's. Joining the Bolsheviks in 1917, he had led the attack on the Winter Palace which overthrew the provisional government. It was he who had burst into the government room, announcing, "In the name of the Military Revolutionary Committee, I declare you arrested." He commanded on the Ukrainian front in the Civil War and later became head of the political administration of the army. Here he had supported Trotsky and was removed in favor of Bubnov. He remained a Trotskyite until 1928, when he submitted, like other oppositionists. He had since been employed in state and diplomatic posts, latterly in Spain. Antonov Avsenko was held in a cell on the third floor of the Butyrka prison. He was ill and, as is often reported of the undernourished and over-interrogated, had swollen legs. But he bore himself boldly and entertained his cellmates with stories of Lenin, the October Revolution, and the Spanish Civil War. One of them was Yuri Tomsky, youngest son of Mikhail Tomsky, who has given an account of Antonov's last days. At the interrogation, Antonov refused to sign anything, though the protocols of the interrogation ran, finally, to 300 pages. One day when they were being gone through, there happened to be a radio on in the investigator's office. The NKVD man, I. Schneiderman, called Antonov an enemy of the people. The prisoner retorted, "You are an enemy of the people. You are a regular fascist." The radio started to broadcast a mass meeting. "Listen. Listen to how the people celebrate us. They trust us in everything, and you will be annihilated." "There," the NKVD official added, "I have had a medal on your account, an Order of the Red Star, in the December 19, 1937 honors list." Antonov Avsenko was sentenced to 10 years with the group executed on 8 February 1938, but was in fact shot. When he was taken from his cell to execution, he took off his overcoat, shoes, and jacket and distributed them to the other prisoners, and then remarked, "Young Tomsky tells us, I beg anyone who gets to freedom to tell the people that Antonov Avsenko was a Bolshevik and remained a Bolshevik till his last day." The chief warders then led him away. Antonov had himself served as state prosecutor in the early 1930s. He had to wait 25 years for his message to be published to the Russian people. All the same, he was lucky. The Mensheviks who died in camps after the 1931 trial or the social revolutionaries like Spiridonova were not similarly vindicated. Meanwhile, other diplomats were being recalled for execution. The Soviet minister in Bucharest, Ostrovsky, hesitated to return to Moscow, but went back when Voroshilov, with whom he had served in the Civil War, gave him a personal assurance of his safety. He was arrested on reaching the frontier, plus though only sent to labor camp. Others who disappeared included the Soviet